1 Corinthians chapter 14. You know, the Bible is an amazing, amazing book, which you would expect it to be when it's given to us by an amazing God. But God saw fit to give us the answers to just about everything that we could possibly ask in this book. And if you don't believe that, then just come up with a question, a Bible question. Go talk to some people about the Bible and let them ask you some questions. And then go see if the Bible doesn't answer it. When you read 1 Corinthians chapters 12, 13, and 14, you read a section here about spiritual gifts that God deals with in great detail to give us a very clear understanding about these matters. In chapter 12, he told the church at Corinth what kind of gifts they had or could have as members of that early church. But he told them in chapter 13 that those gifts were not going to last very long. They would only last until the completed revelation of God was given to man. And once they had that perfect, complete revelation of God, they wouldn't need those pieces and parts. They wouldn't need those gifts any longer. But then in chapter 14, he said, as long as you have these gifts, here's how you need to use them. Here's how you need to properly exercise them and allow them to be regulated. And we have looked at most of chapter 14, but I want us to pick up in verse 26 tonight as we finish this chapter. In chapter 14, Paul has dealt mainly with two of the gifts, with the gift of speaking in tongues and with the gift of prophecy. And he has talked to them about how these were to be properly used in the assembly of the church. And look in verse 19 for just a minute to see that he is talking about an assembly of the church. He says in verse 18, I thank my God, I speak with tongues more than you all, yet in the church. He's talking about in the assembly. I'd rather speak 5 words with understanding than 10 words in a tongue. Drop down to verse 23. Verse 23 says, therefore, if the whole church comes together in one place. He's talking about how these gifts are to be regulated and how they were to be used in the assembly of the church in the first century. Now let's come to verse 26. How is it then, brethren, when you come together? There it is again. We need to understand this is talking about the church assembling together. How is it that when you come together, that each of you has a psalm, has a teaching, has a tongue, has a revelation, has an interpretation? We talked about this verse briefly last week. The idea here is that they were coming together, but each of them had some kind of a selfish desire to be right at the center of attention. Each of them had some kind of a desire, an individual desire, wanting attention, and so they'd all claim, well, I've got this and I've got that, and I want to share this and I want to share that. And if you go back up to verse 23, he had talked about there being commotion or being misunderstandings in assemblies and visitors to the assembly saying, boy, these people are just out of their mind. So he told them in verse 26, look at the end of verse 26. Here is the first rule that they were to follow, that everything must be done. Let all things be done for edification. He says, if you come together and everybody, well, I've got a psalm. No, I've got a teaching. I've got an interpretation. I've got this. I've got that. And if you're all saying this and everybody wants attention and everybody's got to exercise their individualism in the assembly, he says, here's what you have forgotten. All things need to be done for edification. He said that's not edifying. All things must be done for edification. So here he gives some regulations for speaking in tongues and for prophesying. And we ran through these quickly at the end of class last week, but I want you to underscore these in your mind as to how God says that these tongues, when they existed in the church in the first century, were to be exercised. If anyone speaks in a tongue, let there be how many? 2 or 3 at the very most. When you come together is what he's talking about. Verse 26, when you come together, and if there's going to be anybody speaking in tongues, how many people in the assembly were permitted to speak in tongues? Two or three. That's it. That's the limit. Was everybody in the assembly permitted to speak in tongues? No. Were a lot of people? Were the majority? No. Two or three at the most. Now, were those two or three, when they were speaking in tongues, would they speak in tongues at the same time? Would they be speaking simultaneously? No. Second rule. First rule, two or three at the most. Second rule, each takes a turn. Each in turn. Not at the same time. You each take a turn. What if there's nobody there to interpret? The third rule is somebody's got to interpret. Two or three at the most. Each one takes a turn. Let one interpret. Verse 28. But if there is no interpreter, then let him keep silent in the church, in the assembly. Let him speak to himself and to God. Why was that rule given? If there was no interpreter, you be quiet. Was it going to edify? If he's speaking in tongues and there's nobody there to interpret what he says, where is the edification? It doesn't exist. Instead, what exists is confusion. Verse 23 and verse 33 says God is not the author of confusion. In your assemblies, they're not to be confusing. And so if there is confusion that could take place, what needs to happen? Be quiet. Verse 29 gives similar rules for the prophets. Prophets were ones who would receive a revelation, an inspired revelation from God to speak. They didn't speak in a foreign language. They would speak in the native tongue to themselves and to the people who were there. But notice verse 29 says the same thing for prophets. Let two or three prophets speak. So when they come together, everybody says, well, I've got this and I've got that and I've got this. And Paul says, no. Two or three speak in tongues, one at a time. Prophets, only two or three of you are permitted to speak in the assembly. But let two or three prophets speak and let the others judge. Perhaps talking about those who had the gift of discerning spirits. Let them determine if what is being said is correct. Verse 30, but if anything is revealed to another prophet, to another who sits by, let the first prophet do what? Keep silent. So were two prophets permitted to speak at the same time? No. Two tongue speakers could not speak at the same time. Two prophets could not speak at the same time. Why? What does verse 40 say? If the end of verse 26 says, let all things be done for edification. Verse 40 says, let all things be done decently and in order, in an orderly manner. Well, if one person is speaking at a time, is that an orderly manner? If two or three people are speaking at the same time, is that an orderly manner? Have you ever sat at a dinner table where there were multiple conversations going on at the same time? And you try to follow all of those conversations? I will guarantee that there's not a single male in here who can follow all of those conversations. At some point, you reach the age where you just stop trying. I will also guarantee that most of the ladies in here have no problem following everyone and knowing everything and can jump in between those conversations just as easy as can be. So God gave these rules for the men. You understand? No, I'm kidding about that. But God did give these rules. Because God is not the author of confusion, but wants things done decently and in order. Now, some have not been here, and we're not going to answer this and deal with this in any great length. But chapter 13 specifically teaches that these gifts of tongues and these gifts of prophecy and all of these other gifts would cease, that they would be done away with, when that perfect revelation, completed revelation of God was given. Which means that now that you and I have the completed revelation of God that we hold in our hands, that these gifts, these abilities to speak in tongues, to prophesy, to heal, no longer exist. They were done away with. And so anyone or any ones who claim to have those gifts today are not abiding by what the Scripture teaches. Let alone the fact that in those assemblies where they claim to have these abilities, that even in those assemblies, they don't follow the rules that God gave to those who actually did have these miraculous abilities. When there are unknown gibberish languages being spoken by dozens of people at the same time. None of that matches the Bible, let alone the fact that God said those things were done away with. Verse 31, "For you can all prophesy one by one. For what purpose? That all may learn and all may be encouraged." Back up to verse 3. Look in chapter 14 and verse 3. Does that verse not match what verse 3 says? "But he who prophesies speaks edification," building up, "exhortation," encouraging, "and comfort," compassion, "to man." That's what prophecy does. Edification, exhortation, and comfort. So he says to the prophets in verse 31, when you prophesy one by one, all may learn and all may be encouraged. That's the whole purpose of prophecy. It was not to show off. It was not to gain any attention. It was so that people could learn and people could be built up in the faith. Is that any different than the purpose of teaching and preaching today? Should it not be done? Not to gain attention, not for popularity. Should it not be done so that people can learn and people can be encouraged and built up? Notice verse 32 says that the spirit of the prophets is subject unto who? The prophets. Who had control of the prophet's tongue? Who had control over the ability for that prophet to speak or to be silent? The prophet. The spirit of the prophet was subject unto the prophet. What does that mean? That means when somebody makes a claim that says, "Well, God just put it in my heart and I just had to get it out." Could a prophet back then say that? If a prophet said, "Oh, I got to say this, I got to say this, I got to say this, I just got to say..." Well, do you? Or can you control it? Can you wait your turn? Yeah, you can wait your turn because the spirit of the prophet is subject unto the prophets. If God told them to keep silent, did they have the ability to keep silent or not? If those tongue speakers, if there was no interpreter, did they have the ability to keep silent or did they not? Yeah, God told them to keep silent. They had that ability. Here's a prophet. Did he have the ability to keep silent, wait his turn or not? Yes. Because the spirit of those prophets was subject unto those prophets. Otherwise, what does verse 33 say? Otherwise, you have an assembly that is full of confusion and disorder. Now, if there is an assembly that is characterized by confusion and disorder, who caused that to happen? God or man? What does verse 33 say? God is not the originator. He's not the author. He's not the cause of confusion. If there's confusion, if there's multiple tongue speakers, if there's multiple speaking, if there is a assembly which is full of disorder, God says, "That's not my assembly." God's not the author of disorder. He's not the author of confusion, but of peace, as in which ones of the churches? Verse 33. As in all of the churches. Do the rules of God to one church apply to all churches, to all congregations? They do. Let's look at verses 33 and 34. And here's what I want you to do in verses 33 and 34. I want you to let the Bible tell us what God's position is. I don't want you to let society, I don't want you to let religious groups sway you. I just want you to say, what does God say about this matter? Verse 34 says, let your women keep silent in the churches. Have we seen that word silent already in this context? If there was no interpreter, what was the tongue speaker to do? He was to be silent. Notice that that came with a conditional statement in verse 28. If there's no interpreter, let him keep silent. Verse 30 said about the prophets, if something is revealed to another prophet, then the first is to keep silent. Both of those are introduced by a conditional statement. In verse 34, there is no conditional statement. There is no if. It's just a statement from God. And not just a statement, but it is an imperative, the word keep, which indicates this is a command from God, let your women keep silent in the churches. In the churches. In the assemblies. For they are not permitted to speak, but they are to be submissive, as the law also says. And if they want to learn, remember what the purpose of prophecy is? Verse 31, to learn and be encouraged. If they want to learn something, let them ask their own husbands at home rather than in the assembly. For it is shameful for women to speak in the church. I want you to hold your finger there and go over to 1 Timothy chapter 2. And I want you to look at both of these passages as much as you can. I want you to look at both of these passages together. And so just flip back and forth between 1 Corinthians chapter 14 and 1 Timothy chapter 2. We just read verses 34 and 35, 1 Corinthians chapter 14. I want you to look in 1 Timothy chapter 2. Look in verse 8. You know what? Back up from that. Back up to verse 4. Maybe we'll just start there. 1 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 4. The Bible says that God desires all men to be saved. What kind of men does God want to be saved? All of them. Well, is this talking about, does he want all males to be saved? Is that the men that's under discussion in verse 4? Well, yes, he wants all males to be saved. But the word in verse 4 is not exclusive to only males. It's the Greek word anthropos, from which we get the word anthropology. What is anthropology? Study of what? Of what? Of mankind. Is there a study of womankind? That's a loaded question with a bunch of men in here, isn't it? Some of you were trained in the school of never mind. So, is there a different study? If anthropology is the study of mankind, is there like a woman anthropology? When we say the study of mankind, what are we talking about? The human species. Does that include males and females? Yes. So does the Greek word anthropos. So when God says in verse 4 that he desires all men to be saved, he's not talking exclusively about males. It's the word used for mankind. It's talking about everybody, males and females. I point that out because when you get down to verse 8, in the English Bible, you have the word men again. Verse 8 says, I desire therefore that the men pray everywhere. Now, in the English Bible, it's men in verse 4 and it's men in verse 8. But the men in verse 8 is not the Greek word anthropos. It's not the general word for mankind and all humankind. It is the Greek word aner, A-N-E-R, in a transliterated word in English, aner, which means males exclusive of females. It is the word that is intended to talk about the male species. I desire, therefore, verse 8, that the males pray everywhere. Does that mean that women are not allowed to pray? Is that what that verse says? No. But who does God desire to pray in a leadership role everywhere? What does that say about, just in a universal application, what does that say? Why would God use the word on air? Why would He use it exclusive to only males? Was there some reason that He did that? Drop down to verse 11. And here in verse 11, I want you to hold verse 11, 1 Timothy 2, and I want you to go back and look at 1 Corinthians chapter 14 and verse 34 and compare the words in these verses. 1 Timothy 2 says, let a woman. 1 Corinthians chapter 14, verse 34 says, let your women. Starts out the same way. Let a woman, 1 Timothy 2, learn. Well, that's what God wants them to do in 1 Corinthians chapter 14, verse 35. He wants them to learn. 1 Timothy chapter 2, let a woman learn in silence. 1 Corinthians 14, verse 34, let your women keep silent in the churches. 1 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 11, let a woman learn in silence with all submission. 1 Corinthians chapter 14, verse 34, let your women keep silent in churches, for they are not permitted to speak, but they are to be submissive. Submission is mentioned in both of these passages. 1 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 12, what does it say? And I do not permit a woman to teach. What does 1 Corinthians chapter 14, verse 34 say? Let your women keep silent in the churches, for they are not permitted. God says in 1 Timothy, I do not permit a woman to teach. 1 Corinthians 14, they are not permitted to speak. Now, is God saying in 1 Corinthians chapter 14 and verse 34 that they are never, ever, 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 under any circumstances permitted to speak ever? Guys, the safe answer to that is no. Okay? Is He talking about specific circumstances? Yes, He is. He's talking about those same specific circumstances in 1 Timothy chapter 2. Verse 12, I do not permit a woman to teach or to have or exercise authority. Has God put a period in your sentence yet? Have you found a period in verse 12 yet? Did He say, I do not permit a woman to teach, period? Did you have a period there? I do not permit a woman to teach or to have authority, period. Did He put a period there? You haven't found your period yet, have you? I do not permit a woman to teach or to have authority over a man, but to be in silence. Does that sound like 1 Corinthians 14? Let your women keep silent in the churches, for they are not permitted to speak, but they are to be submissive. Are those passages saying the same thing? Are they talking about the same thing? Is God laying out the same regulations? Did He change? He's talking about similar circumstances. He's talking and He's giving the same exact instructions that there is to be silence, that there is no permission from God, that there is to be submission. Now, somebody says, yeah, but that's just cultural. That was just the culture of the first century. And our culture today is a lot more advanced than first century culture. And women today have been liberated. And let me just say, I thank God that we live in America and not Saudi Arabia or one of those other countries, aren't you? Amen. But what does this say? Do these passages permit the statement or the argument that says, well, that's just cultural and the culture has changed? Neither one of these passages allow it to be a cultural setting. Go back to 1 Corinthians 14. Keep your finger in 1 Timothy 2 because we're coming right to it. 1 Corinthians chapter 14, notice the last five words of verse 34. Your women are to keep silent in the churches. They're not permitted to speak. They are to be submissive as the law also says. Well, what law is that? Was that the Roman law? Is that what Paul's talking about? No. Was it the Greek law, or was it the Corinthian law? What law was that? If you read the book of Romans, and you read the book of Romans, and it talks about the law, it's always talking about the law of Moses, because that was the specific thing under discussion in the book of Romans. But that's the law, the old law of Moses, not necessarily what Paul's talking about. Was there any law given by God to women to be in submission, even before the law of Moses? Something in the Garden of Eden? Go to Genesis chapter 3. I know you're going to run out of fingers here. But go to Genesis chapter 3. When God is explaining the punishments that were to be upon the man and the woman and the serpent for bringing sin into the world, he turns to the woman in Genesis chapter 3 and verse 16 and explains what the consequences would be for her for bringing sin into the world. Genesis 3:16, I will greatly multiply your sorrow and your conception. In pain you shall bring forth children. Now that was just cultural, right? I mean, that we have advanced as a culture, and that's no longer an issue, right? The sorrow, conception, pain, and childbirth, that's a thing of the past. Am I right or wrong? I believe I'm very wrong. Okay, I've never personally experienced it myself, but I've been there, and I don't think this was cultural, was it? What was this temporary? Maybe it was maybe it was just till woman and man, maybe it was just till they learned their lesson. Have we learned our lesson yet? Maybe we've learned our lesson and this was not cultural. So in the first century, was there still sorrow and your conception and pain and childbirth? Was that still around in the first century? Yeah. Still around the 21st century. Had nothing to do with culture. The end of verse 16. Your desire shall be for your husband, toward your husband, and he shall rule over you. Well, that was just cultural, right? That was just limited to the Garden of Eden. That was just limited to the Old Testament, right? Where was the time when God said that no longer applies? If the first part of that verse is still around today, how can we say the second part of that verse is not still applicable today? When Paul says in 1 Corinthians chapter 14, as the law also says that women are to be in submission, as the law also says, what law is that? It goes all the way back to Genesis chapter 3. So the instructions that God is giving in 1 Corinthians chapter 14 had nothing to do with culture. They couldn't have to do with culture because Paul went back more than 4,000 years and he said, this is how it was 4,000 years ago. Culture had nothing to do with it. Now, come to 1 Timothy chapter 2. 1 Timothy chapter 2, it's even clearer in 1 Timothy chapter 2 that it has nothing to do with culture. Because after the instructions that are given in verses 11 and 12 of 1 Timothy chapter 2, what's the first word you have in verse 13? As or for, is that what we have? That's a word that says, here's an explanation. It's a conjunction that's tying those verses in with, here's the explanation for those statements. Because as for, Adam was formed first, then Eve. Is the role of women in the church, was it cultural? God says, this is the reason, these are the instructions I'm giving because of the creation order. That doesn't tie it to culture. That goes all the way back to the beginning. Verse 14, and Adam was not deceived, but the woman being deceived fell into transgression. Because of the creation order, And because of the deception and sin that the woman brought into the world, God says, that is the reason that I have specified this special position for them in the church. Does God not like women? Is God a chauvinist? Was Paul a chauvinist? When God says that your desire shall be towards your husband and he shall rule over you, is that because that he didn't like women and he was a woman basher? Had nothing to do with that. When God got ready to make a help meet for Adam, what did God make? Did God make a photocopy of Adam? Thank God that he did not. He made him a help meet that would be compatible to him. Does that mean that she's inferior? No, the Bible never says or would indicate that anyone is superior or inferior. In fact, 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 7, when it talks about the relationship between husband and wife, it talks about them being heirs together of the grace of God. In God's eyes, they are equal heirs to His grace. So what about these verses, 1 Timothy 2 and 1 Corinthians 4? We've got 3.5 minutes here. What about these verses today? What about these verses in the church today? Should we just ignore them? Should we just say that was a thing of the past? And we are more advanced than that today. Should we say, well, that was just a cultural thing back then, and Paul was dealing with a cultural matter that existed in Ephesus for 1 Timothy and Corinth and 1 Corinthians, but we don't have that today. God tied it to the very beginning. It wasn't cultural. God said it in more than one place in the New Testament to let us know that it did not have anything to do with a specified situation in one setting or one place in the church, but it was a rule. Go back to 1 Corinthians chapter 14, verse 33. What were those last words of verse 33? He's not the author of confusion, but of peace. Now, was that in some of the churches or in all of the churches? All of the churches. Go back. You got 1 Corinthians open? Go back to chapter 4 and verse 17. When Paul gave instructions to churches, 1 Corinthians chapter 4 and verse 17, he says, as I taught, as I gave everywhere in every church. The same thing that Paul taught in one church, he taught in every church. Chapter 4 and verse 17 says the same thing in chapter 7 and verse 17. As I ordain in all the churches, chapter 7 and verse 17. So these were instructions that were not specified just for one place, but for all of the Lord's church. Does it have application for us today? There is no reason at all that those passages do not have application for us today. They absolutely do, because God, 2,000 years ago, said, this is the way it has been for 4,000 plus years. Why would we think that 2,000 years to this side of that statement, it would be any different? It's not any different. So what are we saying? Are we saying that... we've got 1 minute. We're saying that women are not permitted to speak in a Bible class like this? Some of you women already have. And I'm thankful that you have. What does 1 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 12 specifically say? Do not permit a woman to teach or to exercise authority over the man. In a setting like this, has there been any woman who's made a comment who has exercised authority over me as the teacher? No. in Ephesians chapter 5 and verse 19. Ephesians 5 and verse 19 says, speaking. You heard that word before? You heard it in 1 Corinthians 14 and in 1 Timothy 2. Ephesians chapter 5 verse 19 says, speaking to one another. Who's supposed to do that? And in Ephesians 5 verse 19, the speaking to one another is supposed to happen as a reciprocal pronoun, that some are speaking to these and these are speaking to the others, and they're all speaking to one another. Well, that sounds confusing. I thought that's what God said was not supposed to happen. That sounds off. Like, no, it's not. What's happening in Ephesians 5:19? Speaking to one another in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, singing and making melody in your heart to the Lord. Now, who's permitted to do that? Men or women? Everybody's commanded to do it. If women are permitted to do that in the assembly, does that mean that they're not allowed to make a peep at all? Not one in a position of authority. Are they permitted to sing? Are they permitted to make comments in a setting like this? Are they permitted, thankfully, to teach these classes that we have on Sundays and Wednesdays? You know who's made this issue confusing? Man has. We've made it confusing. These verses are not confusing. They're not hard to understand. They may be hard in some places to apply and to put into practice, but that's only because of man being in those places. I know that there are all sorts of little questions that come about as a result of these passages in this discussion. I'm sorry we didn't have time to get to some of them. But the question of making comments is, in a class, is often one that's brought up. But the Bible indicates that that's perfectly acceptable in that kind of setting. I know you may have some questions. You may want to talk about this further. I don't intend to spend a lot of class time on this after tonight, but I did want to spend plenty of time looking at this tonight. If you have any questions at all, please let me know. Hopefully this has been helpful to you, and we'll pick up and get into chapter 15 next week.